So you want to know something about my early history just to set the stage in context.
This
would be primarily in those days of the late 40s and very early 50s of the Düring group.
That's right. I'm covering the period from a whole early development, really from 1900 to about 1950, but actually the major emphasis is going to be 1925 to 1950 because...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's see.
Okay.
This is Leon Gortler interviewing Professor Andrew Streitwieser in his office in Latimer Hall at the University of California on January 22nd, 1981. And I know you were born in Buffalo, New York on June 23rd, 1927, but I know very little else about your early life. And could you tell me a little bit about your family and about your early schooling?
Okay. My early life was at best lower middle class.
Okay.
My parents in the early days were very poor. My father, both my parents came over from Germany after World War I. They met in Buffalo and married there.
Could you give me their names?
Yes, my father was Andrew, and my mother was Sophie Morlock. My father was born in Munich, Germany. My mother in a little town called Obertal. Obertal is O-B-E-R-T-A-L, and it's in the Baden-Württemberg area of Germany. They were both in their, well, I guess my mother was in her late teens. She was probably when she came. But at any rate, they met, married, and somewhat more than a year later I was born. And my brother was born in Buffalo 3 years after that. My father was a carpenter with the Pierce Arrow Company, and when that folded in the early Depression, he thought the employment opportunities would be better in New York, and so around 1930 or 31, we moved to New York. And life in those early Depression days was very hard. My father got intermittent work as a carpenter, and but then, in the late 30s, it improved, especially when he got employment helping to build World's Fair. And so, in 1937, they had saved enough to put down a $100 down payment on a house in Jamaica, Long Island. Mm-hmm. That house, I think the total price of that house is $2,900. Incredible nowadays. So we moved, and after that, life improved considerably, so it really became more solid middle class. My father changed business. He became the manager of a local Roto-Rooter agency in Queens, and in fact, as a teenager, and later I cleaned out many a sewer myself. So I went to the public schools in the Bronx, where we first lived, and then in Jamaica, Long Island. But for high school, I went to Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan and commuted from Jamaica. Took 1 hour each way, and I remember those early mornings walking in Manhattan to high school. But that worked out very well because I met some lifelong friends there. Ed Kossauer is one example of a friend that I've had since those days. And, of course, he's been a very successful chemist in his own right. Ed and I, in fact, participated in the Westinghouse Science Talent Search the first year that Stuyvesant High School participated in that, and both of us became the trip winners to Washington of the 40 trip winners. So our high school did very well that year, and Ed went on to become the major winner. He was the top awardee of the year. After high school, I went to Columbia, and because our finances were still, very constrained, I had worked part-time after school in high school and saved up a lot of money for my own college career. But by staying at home, I was able to save money commuting to college. Mm-hmm. I finished, that was the war year.
So you started Columbia?
I started Columbia, actually I finished high school in 3.5 years by going to summer school. Those were the days of acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finished finished high school in the winter of 40, let's see, where are we now, 44 to 45, and I started Columbia in the spring semester of 1945. That was around March of 1945, mm-hmm. February. I finished two regular semesters and the summer session in between before I was drafted in February of 1946, and then spent a year and a half in the Army. That career was mostly in the U.S. Army Medical Corps, and I was stationed at an Army hospital in Denver, Fitzsimmons General Hospital, mm-hmm. where I was a clerk. And I was discharged in August of 1947, just in time to make the fall semester at Columbia. And after two more semesters in the summer session, I graduated. While I was in the Army in Denver, I was able to take courses at the Extension School of the University of Colorado in Denver, and got credit for differential equations and French. And with those units, and by taking heavy loads, I was able to, I actually completed college in less than 4 years, including the year and a half in the Army. Those are real days of acceleration.
Yeah, that must have been, that's incredible. Let me go back for just a minute and pick up a couple of details. Let's see, were there any instructors that were particularly influential or books that were influential while you were growing up? Obviously you had it.
When I was in grade school, still in the Bronx, I became interested in astronomy in a roundabout way. When I was about nine, I would see horoscopes in the paper, mm-hmm. and so I became interested in astrology and went to the public library and took out a book on, turned out, on astronomy. That book taught me the difference, and it was a marvelous book. I wish I could remember it, because it was pegged at a level I could follow, and it was in a conversational style of an adult talking to a group of children and pointing out the constellations. And that was marvelous, to see these constellations and to recognize them and then go out and be able to see them myself in the sky. So very early I became an astronomer. I joined the Junior Astronomy Club at the Hayden Planetarium, and even at that young age, I would go to monthly meetings of the Junior Astronomy Club, using the subways and the light. I doubt that anyone would do that nowadays in New York, but it was a different world then. And I continued that until... Okay, and during that period, when I was in fifth grade, I was influenced by one particular teacher, a Mrs. Decker, with two K's that I remember. She taught science in PS 85 in the Bronx. And she had a very unusual class. She had lots of various naturalist items in the classroom, including a dinosaur bone. She had known Roy Chapman Andrews, who had discovered dinosaurs in the American West. And so she had these artifacts. I remember once she took me out somewhere, was it to a museum or someplace? I remember I went out with her, just the two of us one evening. And I remember having a meal at the Automat. And so she really had an important influence. We had a classroom newspaper, which I edited at that period. I remember we also had a little baby alligator, a one-foot alligator who had to be force-fed. And so that was the responsibility of one little group in the class who had the responsibility of feeding the alligator. And we had a rabbit and mice and so on. So I'm sure she had a definite influence. Mm-hmm. But chemistry came later. Chemistry came at the age of 11 when I was given a chemistry set for Christmas. Then that was followed by a larger chemistry set the following June for my birthday, and after that I was a chemist.
That's incredible. Did your parents, aside from giving you a chemistry, except that they have other influences on you in terms of...
Oh, no. All they did was, their biggest influence is to let me go, take my lead and go, mm-hmm. Without restraint. They, their own education was very limited. Neither of them graduated from a grammar school.
Mm-hmm.
The most negative influence they had, however, was in my early youth, they spoke only German at home. And just about the time that would have done some good, and I could have become bilingual, they stopped and switched to English. Well, because they thought, I guess it's the effect of wanting to be American and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad that they hadn't, because I would very much appreciate being fluent in German now.
Mm-hmm.
However, enough of that carried through that my German pronunciation is not as bad as typical Americans.
I noticed that you have a number of German publications. Have these been translated by other people, or have you written
them? No, my German isn't that good.
I see.
I've given lectures in Germany in German, but they've been read, and they were lectures that I first wrote in German, and then that German was gone over by friends who converted into good German.
I see, okay. Right. And your brother, did he go on and...
My brother is not a scientist. He was... he suffered from being the younger of the family and didn't do well in his early schooling. But then, about the time I left and first went in the army and he was freed from having an older brother around, he blossomed.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually went to Columbia College himself, graduated, became a teacher, and he now teaches a high school in modern history, contemporary events, and economics in Long Island.
What's your brother's name?
William.
Okay.
He's 3 years younger.
Got me. I suppose as a result of these early influences, you decided to go to college.
Well, I remember that thoughts in my, for example, early high school, there was a lot of doubt even that I would be going to college. Going to college was a major undertaking then,
mm-hmm.
and of course it's something I wanted to do but wasn't at all assured of in those days. By the time I got in the higher levels in high school, I knew definitely I was going to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time I entered the Westinghouse Science Talent Search, I was going to go one way or another.
Mm-hmm. And you were supported primarily through your own labors and...
we had the GI Bill.
That's right.
And that, of course, was a godsend.
Right.
That I had saved about $1,000 on my own. Which is a major amount of money in those days. At that time, it cost $200 a semester to go to Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that and living at home living at home was a major aspect that my parents provided at that time.
Were there? Now I can't forget this. There's a publication that you had in 1945.
Oh yes.
And it's the
yes,
exactly. Coronation of Fluorine.
That's the infamous story of organic specialties. That, which is a marvelous story that many people know. It came about, it started actually primarily by Lester Friedman, who is another high school friend, and Ed Kossauer. They had noticed we used to get the CNE News regularly. And one of the items that appeared weekly in the CNE News was an article on wanted chemicals by the Armour Research Foundation. And they had noted that a lot of these were ordinary common organic chemicals that anyone could make.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, we didn't have Aldrich and a lot of other specialty chemical companies. The only place where one could get chemicals was Kodak. And their list is rather limited. And so we thought we'd go into Ed and Lester first started going into this business, and they tried to get me to join them, but I was reluctant to do this until they showed me an order in hand from the General Electric Company for 100 grams of 135 trichlorobenzene. Now, we knew that this is an easy thing to make. All you had to do was chlorinate aniline and deaminate. And with this order in hand, I invested my $11.
This was, you were still in high school.
But yes.
But you knew about organic preparations?
Oh, yes. We were quite active in organic chemistry in those days. We, in effect, taught ourselves and taught each other. I remember going through exercises in organic nomenclature. We used to draw complex structures to each other and ask, just as a problem, to name.
What kind of textbooks were you using?
Just books from the library. I remember at one stage, early in my teens, I must have been about 13 or 14, thinking that I was only going to be an inorganic chemist. I remember a quiz program we were listening to at home one day on the radio, and there was a chemist from DuPont, and he gave his occupation as an organic chemist. And I remember remarking to my parents that I'm going to be an inorganic chemist, not an organic chemist. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I really didn't understand any organic chemistry. But then I got a book out from the library that started with a blend of the two. It started with typical inorganic chemistry, and it merged into organic chemistry so gradually I could understand it. And so for the first time, I was able to see what organic chemistry was like and what a fascinating field it was. Rather early, I became interested in theoretical aspects. And when Remick's book on, Modern Electronic Theories of Organic Chemistry came out in 1941, I bought a copy that I still have. Mm-hmm. And it's a wartime edition with the narrow margins and the thin paper. And I read it, and I really didn't understand it completely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Resonance structures were a fascination, but I really didn't understand what they were. Yeah. But it showed the earliest beginnings of what I was, mm-hmm. where my interests were going. Yeah. So Remick had an influence beyond what he may have thought at that time. Mm-hmm. I remember I took that book with me to Washington on that Westinghouse trip, mm-hmm. and I remember reading it there. But that gets away from the story of organic specialties.
Yes.
For example, we each had copies of the chemical rubber book on chemistry. That was a real bargain. It cost something like $3 at that time,
mm-hmm.
and it was very thick even then. And to have so much data. $3. That was it was a sense of power that we had.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so with this order in hand, I invested my $11, and the three of us then took the plunge to the with organic specialties. Some of this money was used to get letterhead stationery that said organic specialties, and we used the address of Lester Friedman's parents. Their parents ran a woman's lingerie shop on 2nd Avenue and 14th Street. And it was in the basement of this store that Lester had his laboratory, which was very well equipped. But the first experiment, the chlorination of aniline, we did out at my house, because across the street from where I lived was a large empty lot with a couple of old foundations. And this was since we didn't have hoods,
yes.
We used the open air for this. We bought a lecture bottle of chlorine and a yoke, and we learned how to use it, had to figure out how one uses lecture bottles of gases. And we ran the chlorination of the aniline at that time. And then that was done on one Saturday. And I took the product and worked it up to one stage, isolated the trichloroaniline, and then passed it on to one of the others for the deamination. One of the things we learned is that organic chemistry in the laboratory isn't the same as organic chemistry in books. That it takes practice and experience to run reactions, and that was a valuable experience, because what we ended up with was 50 grams of yellow material that was the best we could do, but we sent it off and we got part payment anyway.
Mm-hmm.
However, that experience soured me on industrial chemistry. And I went back to fundamental research in my own home laboratory. I had a home lab myself,
mm-hmm.
in the basement of our house in Jamaica. And And one of the things we used to get free samples of compounds. So from the Copperas Chemical Company, I was able to get free samples of phenanthrene and anthracene and fluorine. So it's amusing that a lot of my recent research has been with the hydrocarbon fluorine, but my earliest work was with fluorine.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that. Yeah.
And of course, I had no real appreciation for what the novel features of fluorine were, and fluorine plus two and its anion and all the rest at that mm-hmm. time. But aromatic chemistry was interesting because it was relatively simple and one could follow it. And it, aromatic substitution so was an interest even then with polycyclic hydrocarbons. That was an era of when polycyclic hydrocarbon chemistry was an important part of organic chemistry because it was much simpler in many respects than aliphatic chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And I could sense this, I think, even then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that I had the sample of sulfuryl chloride that probably came from Hooker as mm-hmm. a sample. And so all I had to do was provide the ether, and I noticed that H.C. Brown had an article on chlorinations with sulfuryl chloride. And in this article, one of the compounds that he chlorinated was fluorine. But he didn't give the what the product was. He just indicated that this had been done. So in my home laboratory, I repeated that experiment, and I isolated a chlorofluorine, which I thought was probably the two, because I knew that that was the prevalent position of substitution in that fluorine molecule. I made two chlorofluorine from the amine. I knew about organic syntheses in those days. Organic syntheses had the nitration and reduction of fluorine, and I carried out those reactions according to the Ordzin specification, made the amine, and ran the Sandmeyer reaction to get the fluoride so I could do a mixed melding test,
mm-hmm.
and showed that I did have the two positions, then wrote that up in a little note. Now, all this time I did this, and I wrote it up as a note, and it got accepted, and I didn't tell my friends about it. I wanted it to be a surprise. And so when it was published, then they found out about it, and it was a local hero for a while at
mm-hmm.
that time. They reciprocated because as part of the organic specialty that they continued, they had to make the 3-ketoglutaric acid. And they worked out a procedure for it, developed that preparation, and submitted it to organic syntheses, and it was accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas I put an acknowledgement to their assistance in my paper, they put down an acknowledgement to my assistance in theirs,
mm-hmm.
but in truth, I didn't help in that work and they didn't contribute to my paper.
I see.
Organic specialties lasted until we finished high school and we all went our separate ways. There's one other cute aspect of that. We needed to have a library, you know, to go and look up the original references. And the only place where we could really get all of these references was the New York Public Library, the 42nd Street branch on Fifth Avenue. However,
did you know the Chemist Club at that time? Was there?
No, there was probably one, but I've never been a member of it. But high school students were not permitted in that library because they were just taking it over. And so what we did was on Organic Specialties letterhead stationery, we typed out a letter to the library requesting that the bearer, Andrew Starweather Jr., who was in the employ of Organic Specialties, be allowed to use the library. And it was signed, I think Lester signed it. And I used this letter. And I got permission to use the library, got a little card giving me this permission to go into the stacks.
Very nice.
And I remember having to read some Russian literature at that time and going through it letter by letter.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to find somebody who translated, or you?
Oh, I had to do it. I used the Russian dictionary that was there and just went through it letter by letter.
Once you started at Columbia, were there particular courses I take it you started out taking chemistry courses right away.
Yes.
Who was there? Who was doing the teaching?
Okay, let's see. When I started at Columbia, I started in mid-year, and I had kept careful notes of the experiments that I did. Kept cards and a notebook. In fact, I still have some notebooks of the experiments I did in those days. Mm-hmm. I had occasion to go through them a few months ago, and I was pleased and rather surprised at the care and detail of the observations that were made. Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten all of that. But at any rate, I had these recorded, and I went to a chemistry professor to see if I should be exempted from freshman chemistry. And he asked me some questions to test the depth of my knowledge, found that I really didn't understand what pH was. But he allowed me to get out of the first semester of freshman chemistry, and I started right in on the second semester. And I found...
Who was the professor who tested you?
I don't recall who that was.
Any idea? Who was the one who was teaching the course in the second semester? Do you remember that?
It would have been one of the inorganic chemists.
Okay.
But I didn't have much experience with him afterwards.
No, not terribly important.
And wasn't Beaver. I just don't remember.
So you started the second semester? Yeah.
I started the second semester, and it was work. It was solid chemistry, and as I recall, I only got a B in the course. I think one of the things that taught me now, in retrospect, is that that kind of advancement isn't worthwhile. It doesn't pay. In those days, there was a lot of pressure to finish up, you know, accelerate and so on. But in general, it's a bad idea.
In my experience.
At any rate, I got through that, and that summer, that was the summer of 1945, I started organic chemistry then. And I remember I took only one semester of organic chemistry. I forget whether I started with the second semester or whether it was the first or what. But the organic chemistry I knew, and I had already done enough experimentation that I was sufficiently adept in the laboratory, so I could get an A in that course.
And you remember who was teaching that?
Yes. The first course I took was not the organic chemistry, the inorganic chemistry course I took was taught by an assistant professor who didn't make tenure. I'm not sure of his name, maybe it was Barnes. But the second semester, that summer, the organic chemistry, who taught the organic chemistry? I think it was Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
He was either Dawson, no, there was an older chemist who retired shortly after that. What was his name?
You can't recall. I have some lists of Columbia faculty around that time, and I'll look through.
Well, he was one of the regular organic faculty who was already, he was close to retirement at that age.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had it with him. It was either with him or with Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall exactly.
Okay, that's all right. Do you remember any textbooks? What textbook they used?
Yes, it was Caldwell's Organic Chemistry.
Mm-hmm. That's one I have not run across.
I don't think it's particularly distinguished. I don't remember anything special about it.
Okay.
It was a classical organic textbook.
Fine. And then that fall, you went back again, or were you...
Yes, then that fall I continued. I can't remember exactly what I took that fall. Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember there was one other thing about that summer. During started, it was that summer that I sat in on, during that summer gave a his advanced course, I guess it was S-147. It was an advanced organic chemistry course with reaction mechanisms and the like. And I sat in on that course. I asked for permission to sit in. I didn't tell him I was taking sophomore again at simultaneously, but he found out independently. And he let me sit in on the course and take all of the exams. Mm-hmm. And he actually gave me a grade. It was a B or a B plus on it. And I thought, taking during with that summer session course.
And he just started at Columbia, or
he had just about started there. I guess it was it was the year before that he had that he and Woodward had the synthesis of quinine.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the first major natural product syntheses at that time that started Woodward in his
I'd say he was a student of Woodward's, or they somehow
worked. No, I don't think they were really students, but they were collaborators.
I see, okay.
Woodward had started at Harvard. During was a graduate student, first with Noller, Noller. It was not the Stanford Noller, but an earlier Noller. I think he got his master's degree with him. And he did his PhD work with the Britisher, who went back to England.
Oh, I have that name somewhere. I know, okay.
Stereochemistry work. But anyway, I think that's where the association began.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was never any formal, Dering was never a formal student of Woodward's, but the two worked together. And the quinine synthesis may very well have been Woodward's ideas with Dering's hands. Dering was an excellent experimenter.
Mm-hmm.
Although he was, of course, he knew what was going on. He was a first-rate chemist,
yes.
And I'm sure that, he and Woodward were, so far as I know, were lifelong friends when it started at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably, I hope that's something that you can do. I don't know if you've interviewed Dering, but...
No, I think I probably should.
But certainly that's that would be something you should do, because it gets back to that era, the early days of Woodward, that starts modern organic chemistry off in a... it's not really the first half of the 19th century, the 20th century. It's Woodward and Dering started a new phase of organic,
yes.
Of applying modern organic theory to synthesis.
Yes.
And, but anyway, that is certainly something I hope you can follow up on. But Dering, of course, had an important influence on me, because I really loved that stuff. I enjoyed that course immensely.
Mm-hmm.
It was just what I wanted, and it set the direction, of course, of my whole subsequent career.
Do you remember whether he used a textbook or he lectured from
the
lecture?
No, it was entirely from his notes. There was no textbook in those days. The
Hammett's book.
There was Hammett's book, which was really different. It was a physical organic chemistry, to be sure. There was Hammett's book, there was Branch and Calvin, and there was Remick.
Mm-hmm.
All of them published during the same era, around 1941.
Yeah.
But Dering went entirely by his lecture notes and his explanations.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a more organic chemistry kind of approach and structure approach to theory that I suppose the, and this would be important, although I never had any personal association with this background, I judged that it all stemmed originally from Paul Bartlett. That and it had been my thought, even in the late 50s, that Paul Bartlett of Harvard had a really important effect on organic chemistry. I hope you, in fact, you ought to make sure you interview him.
I have.
Oh, please. Then well, you can tell me if, before you tell me anything, I'll give you what my impression has been,
mm-hmm.
Just from gathering evidence around without ever talking about this to anyone. But Harvard, after all, in those days was was where this modern organic chemistry really began. And they all took Bartlett's course in organic reaction mechanisms and physical organic chemistry. And then, right after the war, all of these people branched off and populated universities all over the country and gave variations of Bartlett's course. And I suspect that Dering's course had its origins with Bartlett.
Interesting.
And I think that many of these modern organic chemistry courses had Bartlett as their fundamental inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, people would take their lecture notes and then revise it and give variations of the same course. Is that your impression?
A lot of people went through there. Yes, I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. It's interesting because he and a good many other physical people who of just an earlier era were influenced by a fellow most people have not heard of called Elmer Kohler. And his course was patterned after Kohler's course and so on.
Aha! Uh-huh.
So Kohnet was a student of
yeah, Kohnet and Kohler, of course.
That's right.
And, yeah.
And then...
Kohler was one of the first physical organic chemists.
Hammett took Kohler's course, and just, you can't believe the number of people who ended up...
that's a continuation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Branch, of course, had his book, and he gave a course similar, but I don't think he had the same kind of influence and effect.
Mm-hmm.
That Bartlett had,
yeah.
Because in those days Berkeley was all physical chemistry,
yes,
and no organic chemistry, and so no organic chemists spread out from here the way they did from Harvard.
Yes.
Mm. At any rate, I therefore by this kind of progression,
yeah,
had that same influence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So. That was an important influence. I remember I joined the American Chemical Society about then,
mm-hmm,
and that was, started getting the journals, started reading the journals at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember much of that fall quarter. I may not even have taken much in the way of chemistry that quarter. I know I took physics and math and the like. The only other important influence, and it was an important one in those days, at Columbia, was the Columbia's Contemporary Civilization and Humanities courses. The courses that I still think were super. They just don't exist in many schools. It was an integrated course, the Contemporary Civilization, the History of Western Civilization, based on original readings, original papers, and the humanities that had the first two semesters of humanities, the literature of Western civilization, the music and the art. And those were marvelous influences, because in those days I was all chemistry and science.
Mm-hmm.
And taking the humanities courses, there was one teacher who had an important effect on me. The one limitation of that type of course is that it depends so much on who's teaching it. If you've got a good teacher, it could be fabulous. But I had a mixed experience. Some of the teachers were young, inexperienced, and not very good. But I was very fortunate. The first quarter, the first semester of humanities, I had, I believe his name was Weaver. He died only a few years after that. But he was a marvelous lecturer. He was a dynamic speaker. He loved his subject. And I remember the first lecture, sitting there, and he was talking about the personality of Helen of Troy. And I remember wondering, this woman never existed, a mythical creature. How can one worry about the personality of someone fictional? That's how young and naive I was then. But I learned that semester, and and I've been interested in arts and humanities and so on ever since. So he definitely was one of the major influences in my collegiate career. Probably he and Durin were the two most important influences in college.
Mm-hmm.
And they both happened during that first year before I was drafted. As a result, I remember when I was drafted, I went to the induction center. I took with me a copy of Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, which is a very thick book, and it lasted me for a long time during my basic training. So I was able to keep up with chemistry, although one of the annoying things was while I was in the Army, I wanted to keep up my membership in ACS, and I couldn't. The American Chemical Society would not accept my renewal because I wasn't in school at the time. I was in the Army. I've never forgotten that. I haven't reported this to the American Chemical Society since. I suppose someday I should, to make sure that they changed that policy.
They weren't very patriotic.
So as a result, I wanted to continue getting the journals and keep reading them, but I couldn't. during that period. But I was able to keep up with these other studies. And then when I went back to Columbia, finished my college career.
Were you able to take chemistry courses in Denver or wherever you were staying?
No, it wasn't convenient to take chemistry, but I was able to take French, and as I say, differential equations. The differential equations was very worthwhile. It was taught by an engineer, and it was a good course. It was a very practically oriented course, so that I learned something. I also took advanced calculus by correspondence. That didn't work out as well. Mathematics, some people can learn by reading books, but I find that it's, I need to have a teacher instructing me. So that was the extent of my advanced calculus. I got credit for it, but even now I'm weak when it comes to multiple integrations. Fortunately, I haven't had to do much of that.
You seem to have strengths otherwise in mathematics, so we'll get back to that. So then you came back to Columbia, and,
yes.
And what courses did you take then?
Let's see. I took Hammett's Physical Chemistry. That was an important course. And we used Eastman and Rollison, which was not a good textbook. Hammett is not a dynamic speaker, but it was a good course, and I learned a lot. That's where I learned physical chemistry. I took a course by Kimball, and that was disappointing. That course could have been a good course. It was a course on that would have been quantum chemistry, but he emphasized some stuff, some model calculations he was doing at the time. And they never led anywhere. So that was a course where he was in a position, and in fact, in the previous year, he taught simple MO theory, but not to our year, and I didn't learn it then. And I'm sure that if he had taught it then, I would have eaten it up. So that the course he taught was disappointing. I did learn some things. I did learn aspects of chemical physics with problems, so but I remember that it was the molecular orbital theory of organic chemistry part that I didn't get there and could have.
Should we talk about when you started that, or do you want to get to that in chronological order?
Well, I can mention that because that gets involved. That actually came during graduate school, after my undergraduate years.
Okay. Well, let's finish up the undergraduate years. And
so. Aside from the physical chemistry, the other important course, no, that was undergraduate student. Don't remember much else then. Remember quantitative analysis, I don't remember which year I took that, whether I took that before or after I returned from the Army, but that was a good course. Learned a lot in it. Weighings by analytical balances, swings, and being very careful, and doing a lot of gravimetric and volumetric analysis. Good experience, good course. And the other important course was Beaver's Physical Chemistry Laboratory. That was a major course. That had been one of Ben Widom and I teamed. In that laboratory course, we teamed to do experiments. And Ben and I did that. He claims that I got him through college because he's a completely theoretical chemist, and he says that I did the experiments, and he would write him up, and that got him through college. I don't remember it that way.
How does he spell his last name?
Widom. He's professor of chemistry at Cornell, and in the last few years, he also was elected to the National Academy. So he's done well in his own. There are a lot of people at Columbia in those years who have gone on.
I want some of those names. I've got some of them, but I want to get your recollections, too.
Well, Ben Widom was one. The principal thing I learned in that course was precision of measurements and how you analyze or make error analyses. And that was important. Major effect, major influence. So then I... All right, I graduated and started Columbia. The major...
had you thought of going anywhere else?
Yes. The other place I had applied to was Wisconsin. Columbia, Wisconsin, those were two of the major schools at mm-hmm. that time in organic chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
But for personal reasons, I was involved with a girl in New York at that time, and she was one of the reasons I stayed in New York. But that relationship then petered out. However, during, of course, was the other major effect of going mm-hmm. to Columbia.
Did he make a pitch for you to stay, or is...
I don't remember
okay.
any.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't remember any.
Impressed from that earlier course that
yeah.
taken. Had you done any undergraduate research, or things were going so fast that probably wasn't?
There was no undergraduate research in those days. The time was just filled. I remember after I returned, but I remember one quarter having four afternoons a week taken in this laboratory. And the fifth afternoon, Wednesday, I would play bridge at the student union. And that was how I relaxed, taking an afternoon off the bridge.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then you entered graduate school.
The first year in Columbia in those days, you didn't do any research the first year. You took courses. At the end of the first year, you took a series of qualifying examinations. And when you passed these, then you were ready for research. So then I took Durning's course for credit, the chemistry 147 and 148, and Curtin taught one semester. Curtin was a significant influence in those days too. He was another modern organic chemist, I remember we would wonder which of the two to work with. I had thought at one time of working with Curtin. I talked with him about his research problems. But I guess underneath it all, there was never really any question that I was working with Durning. The one other course that was important during that first year was Advanced Organic Laboratory with advanced preparation. I learned a great deal in that course. Doing large-scale preparations, vacuum distillations, my first hydrogenation, marvelous course, a kind of course that many universities have dropped, and I think that's a bad idea. They've substituted undergraduate research, and it doesn't really compensate. I'm glad that we still have such a course, and I think it's an important one. I think that's one of the reasons that Berkeley undergraduates, when they go to graduate school, are so well prepared for starting research, because they've had this advanced organic laboratory course. My TA in that course was Al Wolf, Alfred Peter Wolf, who was a lab mate in the laboratory which I subsequently was in, and he's been a lifelong, very warm friend. He joined Brookhaven after he graduated. He's been at Brookhaven ever since. So that was courses. The important thing there were some of the student contacts that I made and friendships developed.
Who were some of the people that you
year?
It seemed to be I've gotten some of the names, and it's a very impressive bunch.
Who are some of the people that year? It's hard to... Most of the people that I met during those graduate years, Bill Sims, William Sims, was he worked with Dawson, actually, on Poison Ivy, but he was became friends with him, and that's an association that remains on and off. I haven't seen him in years. But it's the sort of thing that many of these people, that I'm sure they regard each other as friends. I regard them as warm friends, and even though we don't see each other for years, when we do get together, there's a different kind of relationship than because it has deep roots.
Yes.
That compared to many people you meet now. Sims is one. Estelle Kalkstein and Herb Meisley. They got married. And are still married, and we're...
Yes, I know them. I didn't know her. I've met them on occasion because...
Yeah, well, she was a... Herb was one of Doering's students. Estelle worked with Curtin.
Mm-hmm.
And she was an original women's liver even then. We used to have marvelous discussions, lots of fun. Let's see, others. I knew Frank Goodrich. Just by name and face. He was a student of Kimball's. And we became good friends later because we both came to Berkeley at the same time. He to work at Chevron and I to Berkeley. And but we both knew the Sims independently. They, because through music, Frank was a very ardent musician, played the guitar. The Sims sang in the chorus. And so it was through our mutual friendship with the Sims that we got introduced in 1951 when we both independently, the Goodriches and we came to the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And that friendship continued. That has the recent tragedy. Frank died a couple of months ago under very tragic circumstances. He was a professor of chemistry at Clarkson College.
Mm-hmm.
There were several other people that I knew but not very well, knew just by name, mostly with the... another name that comes to mind is Gaidashek. Gaidashek, G-E-I-D-E-S. He's now at the UC San Diego in biophysics. And Gert, G-E-R-T, Ehrlich, E-H-R-L-I-C-H. I forget where he is. But they were in the same physical chemistry laboratory course, so they date back to my undergraduate years.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen either of them in two decades. But again, we know the names, and I'm sure, I'm not even sure I'd recognize either of them,
mm-hmm.
but I'm sure if we did, it'd be fun to get together. Okay, other names. I'm trying to think of other groups. I knew some of the people in Beckman's group. They were all on that top floor of Pappenmeyer Hall, of Chandler, rather.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe some additional names will come to
the
front.
Okay. So
in Doering's group, of course, there were that was a major one.
Yeah.
We were, there was two groups, actually. One group was in one large laboratory that Doering shared with Hammett, and he Doering had six desks in it, and at the time I was there, I overlapped with Al Wolf. Ken Weiberg was in that same lab, and later his spot was taken by Charles DePue, who's now in Colorado. Another person who worked directly across from me and had a very important influence in that phase of my life was Richard Young, Richard W. Young, who, after his PhD, joined the Polaroid Corporation, and he's now, was vice president in charge of research, and I think he's now has some overseas. I haven't seen him in a long time,
mm-hmm.
and haven't kept up with him, but he was an important influence.
Mm-hmm. But you did interact, closely.
Oh, yes, because we were right across from each other.
Okay.
So I learned a lot from them. The other two people, Oogie Whalen, I don't know whatever happened to him. I can't even remember his real first name. Just joined industry and has never had any contact since. And, oh, I should remember the name of the guy who... The labs are arranged in three aisles.
Mm-hmm.
And I shared an aisle with a name I can't... gosh, I should know it. We spent years together. He is a very relaxed fellow, went into industry, and again, haven't heard of since.
I wonder if he's the guy who shares an office with me. Bob Odom? Was Bob Odom around at that time?
Bob Odom came later.
Okay.
Yes, so we did overlap.
All right.
No, I didn't... no, Bob Odom... Don't even remember if Bob Odom was in that laboratory in Havemeyer.
No.
It was called Siberia, because it was isolated from the others.
Okay.
Now, however, other people who were in the Hammett side of the laboratory were postdoctorates, and among them, all three of the people who were there those years, four of them went on. One was Bob Taft.
Yes, I know that.
And
yeah.
So I knew him at that early stage. Another was Warren Watanabe.
Oh, I know of him. Yeah.
Who went on, he's
at Roman Haas, I believe.
Could very well be. And I remember a lot of interactions with Warren.
Mm-hmm. Well, he had already, I don't know if he'd been with Roberts before that, or...
Probably before. He was these were all postdoctorates.
Yeah, because he was with Westheimer, and then he was with Roberts for a while, and then may have gone to Hammett after that. Yeah. Anyway, who were the other...
Let's see. Another one was Joe Levy, who was more biochemistry or biophysical chemistry, mm-hmm. and who was a disaster in the laboratory. Gosh, his experimental technique, we used to comment on. He was a joke in the Gehring group. And Sidney Bernstein. Now, Sid Bernstein has become quite a name.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen him since Columbia. Well, I may have seen him once, but I haven't seen him in decades.
Mm-hmm. His major influence has been where I don't, the name doesn't mean anything to me.
Well, because he's biophysical chemistry.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I don't, aside from knowing the name, I don't remember anything special of anything that went on at that time. All of these people did the kinetic studies with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sid Bernstein, I think, was a graduate student with him
mm-hmm.
at that time. The other three were postdocs. But that's okay. That's all. Those are those names. Jerry Burson was in the Gehring group then, and he was a part of the Chandler Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, who are some of the others? And Jerry was a very good influence. He was a very serious-minded but fair sort of guy. He had an impressive personality even then.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, some of the others.
You'll tell me more about Gehring. Was he running this lab out in the country at that time too?
That started during that period.
I see. Okay, yes. You'll tell me a little bit about that. So after this first year, did you go to Gehring and say,
well,
I'd like to work with you?
All of us, after we were admitted to research,
mm-hmm.
Then we'd go around talking with the organic professors about research problems. Gehring, I never really gave a specific problem. We just talked about some interesting aspects of chemistry,
mm-hmm.
and I joined his group because it was Gehring. And it was that group. And
the other organic chemists that were, the Curtin was still there. And
Curtin was still there.
And Dawson and Gehring. And at any time, did you run across Cope in any of that period?
No. Cope was...
I think he just came and went. He may have been connected.
I never saw Cope there.
He may have been...
I met Cope later at MIT.
His name appears in one catalog sometime during the war years, and I wondered...
Never saw him.
Okay.
I don't think he ever showed up at that
Who
time.
Were the other?
Elderfield.
Okay.
And I took a course with Elderfield, knew him quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Elderfield, Curtin. Then, of course, I had courses. I had thermodynamics with Beckman.
Mm-hmm.
I had a course with what's his name, the spectroscopist, infrared.
Okay, you were talking about the spectroscopist, and
yes,
his name
Ralph
was
Ralph Halford. I worked with Ralph Halford.
That's
H-A-L-F-O-R-D.
Okay.
And he was very low-key, sort of quiet, and was really a very good teacher. But then, as I say, he left and became dean of the graduate school. It was a part of Columbia's administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I remember reading that he died recently. Okay, other teachers. I think that was essentially it. It wasn't very large.
Mm-hmm.
One other, I remember one other incident, an amusing one that that I remember quite vividly. During my very first semester as a graduate student, when I was a teaching assistant. I was a teaching assistant in freshman chemistry, and the lab was run by Julian Miller, who was still finishing his PhD, and he completed the final defense of his dissertation. He had a party. It was typical in those, it was general in those days, to have a party when you finished your oral. And his party was quite a party. Everyone got drunk. The liquor just flowed. And it was quite a revelation to me to see all of these hallowed professors. Remember, I won't mention any names, but I remember one of them sitting against the wall by the door, stroking women's legs as they walked through. I could mention Hammett, who talked about, just told a lot of stories about his boyhood days, I think in Scotland.
Yeah, Hammett grew up in Maine.
Oh, Maine, okay, that right. Would have been it, sure.
Yeah.
Julian Miller, only a few years ago, he went on and worked at the Brookhaven years ago, died very suddenly. Yeah, had warm associations to Berkeley, but I never knew him well after that. So that was my principal association with him.
Mm-hmm. So then you proceeded to do research.
Yes,
yeah.
And one of the important influences in Dorn's group were the group meetings, the seminars. Mm-hmm. They were a wonderful experience. They were in the evening, and a group of us would generally go out to dinner beforehand, often to a local Chinese restaurant or something of the sort, and Dorn often went with us. So we had, those were marvelous occasions. And then have our group meetings, sometimes talking about research, sometimes talking about problems that came up. It was quite common to present some interesting problem in organic chemistry, and I remember what a whiz Dorn was he seemed to know all of the answers, and all of the people involved, all of the literature. But those were working out those problems was certainly an important influence in organic chemistry, and that was. That was a sort of thing, an era of organic chemistry, where that really developed, applying modern reaction mechanisms to the solution of novel rearrangements and the like, of rationalizing results in a way that wouldn't have been possible several decades earlier. And in a sense, I didn't realize it at the time, that that period marked a real transition in organic chemistry. In fact, that kind of thing I don't think even occurred a few years earlier. It was right then that that transition was made. In part, I suppose, also the Woodward influence, because that also went on in Woodward's group. And I'm sure, although I didn't have any direct contact with it, that the same thing, I'm sure, went on in Winstein's group.
Yes, it did.
But it marked a kind of organic chemistry which was new and novel and perhaps unique to those places in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly didn't happen in Germany then, and probably not in England.
Yeah, there's some question in my mind as to why no school of physical organic chemistry was built in England. That is, there wasn't this these offshoots the way there was here in
Ingold
the U.S.
Yeah, Ingold just didn't have that same effect.
Right. One can't even think of an Ingold student that went on. I don't know many of his students, but can you?
No, they didn't
think of one that became a.
About the principal one is. You should know these names. Delamere was one.
Mm-hmm.
And right, he has a little school, but nothing nothing special. There are lots of little names.
Yes.
But no one who's been associated with any marked change in organic chemistry.
Right.
Just more of the same, actually.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What would you like to do at this point?
Okay. What kind of research did you do with during that?
I followed up a problem that was started by Harold Zeiss. Zeiss was a graduate student with Dering who finished just before I started research.
Mm-hmm.
And Zeiss's problem was the first resolution of a tertiary alcohol. He resolved methyl ethyl isobutyl carbonyl and ran one cell volysis of it. And my problem was to start with that and look at the stereochemistry of solvolyses involving tertiary systems, using this particular tertiary system. So in my research, I had to repeat Zeiss's resolution, and I did that. It was a laborious resolution requiring a tremendous fractional crystallization. Well, I learned fractional crystallizations then, and it was a real pyramid that Zeiss, I believe, took down to something like the 22nd level to get optically pure material.
Mm-hmm.
And I repeated this resolution using lots of brucine, the salt I use. And, remember first having to go through the synthesis of the alcohol with the Grignard reaction on a large scale. I remember taking that freshly distilled large amount of material, dropping it and breaking the bottle on the floor. And what a crushing event that was. I soaked up as much as I could with paper toweling to recover material, and as soon as I finished with that, took off and spent the rest of the afternoon on a rowboat in the lake in Central Park to recuperate. But I survived that, went ahead with the resolution, and I was lucky that Zeiss worked in Chandler, which is an old building. I worked in Havemeyer, which is a different building, and sometimes these crystallizations can be very fluky. Midway in the course of this normal resolution, where I got these tight little hemispherical igloos that Zeiss reported, all of a sudden in some of the fractions, I got a new crystalline form, a transparent prisms instead. And these kept coming up. And when I checked, I found that it was the other enantiomer. And in fact, when I used those as seeds, this resolution, which was a very long and laborious one, became a very quick one. Once you get optically pure material with just a few crystallizations instead of this long, laborious one.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, there was some old dust in the air or something, but this sort of thing can happen.
Yes.
And stories I'm sure people can tell of going from one building to another and all of a sudden it crystallizes. I took that material, went through and looked at the hydrogen phthalate ester and its solvolyses under a number of different conditions, and the primary result was that we learned that these tertiary systems do not go with complete racemization. They go with substantial amounts of inversion of configuration. And that fostered Döring's view of the salvolysis reaction involving a modification of the SN2 displacement reaction, where an intermediate is involved, and a hierarchy, or generally just a gradual gradation from the SN2 transition state to salvolysis intermediates. That view that involves specific structural roles to solvent at the rear never really took hold. That occurred at the same time as Winstein's formulation of ion pairs. And it's been the ion pair aspect that has taken hold. Mm-hmm. Now, there's no doubt that at this time that in many of these kinds of solvolytic reactions, covalency is involved to specific solvent molecules in the rear, but the Döring picture has never really caught on. Mm-hmm. But that there was an era, this period in the late 40s, early 50s, well, the whole period of the 50s, when salvolysis reactions were all the rage.
And that was your first contact with them, because later on it became very important for you.
Yes.
Certainly with the review. And so that work was never published.
No, the only place it was published was in my review. Mm-hmm. In effect, I published it myself, but the experimental details were never published.
How about the MO, the molecular orbital?
That started, Döring gave a seminar once at our group meetings in which he talked about 4N plus 2 and talked about Hückel and the 4N plus 2 rule that he in turn had gotten from Kimball. Mm-hmm. And that's when I first encountered beta. But I really didn't understand it. I just heard about it, knew of the significance of 4N plus 2 and some of the consequences. Mm-hmm. Döring, of course, went on and he looked at tropylene cation and knew about cyclopentadienyl anion and the like. And that had an important influence on his work, especially at Katona. And that's another story that we can develop. But I really learned MO theory when I did postdoctoral work with Roberts at MIT.
Yes, okay.
And you want to follow that story?
I don't know whether we should stop and you tell me a little bit about Katona, or we should do the other.
Well, okay, I can't tell you very much about Katona,
okay.
So we can
I know
do that.
A little bit about it. I know that. Yeah, go ahead, tell me what you know.
What I know is that Döring had a graduate student, what's her name, Alice Wiles, who was a wealthy woman in her own right and wanted a PhD and got it with Döring before my time.
Mm-hmm.
And then she set him up in this laboratory at Katona where he had postdoctoral students working.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the tropylium work went on, making tropylium cation.
Mm-hmm.
That work he had a black student working with him.
Larry Knox.
Larry Knox, of course. Yeah. And I didn't know Larry very well. I knew him.
Mm-hmm.
But not because he was up at Katona, rarely came into the city. I remember visiting Katona once,
mm-hmm.
Maybe once or twice. They had a disastrous fire. The tropylium system was made then by photolysis of diazomethane and benzene, and that was done on a large scale. So they had a benzene solution of diazomethane circulating past the lamp, and somehow it caught the fire, and that was a lot of benzene on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Destroyed the laboratory.
Oh, and that was the end.
Or at least destroyed a part of it. No, that wasn't the end at that time. It still went on when I left Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it went on until she died And then the family, as soon as they got hold of the estate, closed it out.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember who was chairman of the
army department at that time?
Yes. Fahrenthold. Martin H. Fahrenthold, who taught freshman chemistry.
Hmm.
He was a nice guy, I mean, a lightweight chemist, but a very, you know, very pleasant sort of guy. I don't know how he was as chairman, but that was a good role for him.
Aside from the Düring seminar, were there other seminars that you remember, or kinds of communication that went on between? I mean, I assume you were talking to all these people who you mentioned before about chemistry.
Oh, yes. The full sessions in the laboratory, discussions about laboratory problems. That was where Al Wolf and Dick Young had their major effect, because we did lots of discussion of chemical problems at the blackboard and working out ideas.
After you finished your PhD, I take it you decided to go to MIT.
Yes.
Was the fellowship that you got on your own, or did
Jim? It was on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a research proposal based on deuterium exchange of esters with base. And it was a perfectly good proposal. I was going to look at the effect of ring size in cycloalkyl esters. And still would have been a good proposal. But I remember at about that time, I had gotten the award and was going up to MIT to look for a place to live and make those arrangements. When I thought of hydrogen deuterium asymmetry as a way of looking at the stereochemistry of primary systems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the important influence there was that Dick Young's research problem with Düring was asymmetric induction in the Meyrine-Pondorf reduction
mm-hmm.
of ketones. That is, using an optically active secondary alcohol to transfer a hydride to a ketone and to see how much optical activity was induced in the product secondary alcohol. And he found that indeed there is asymmetric induction in that, and that you can explain it quite well in terms of the cyclic transition state used for that reduction. And I conceived of the idea of applying that method to aldehydes and transferring the deuterium as a way of making optically active primary alcohols.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggested this to Roberts, and he let me go ahead with it.
Okay. You went there to, you were going to go and work in Roberts' lab?
Yes.
Okay, with
and
your
I
fellowship?
Did.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. With my fellowship, and he let me work on my own problem,
mm-hmm.
Which is rather rare.
Yeah.
And I did, and that worked out successfully.
Key insight then.
An important influence there was Bill Saunders. William H. Saunders, mm-hmm. now at Rochester, was a postdoc with Roberts. And he stayed on with Roberts for a year after I left.
Mm-hmm.
And then went on to Rochester.
How did you decide to go up to MIT?
Well, I discussed with Düring who I ought to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of possibilities. Winstein and Roberts were two of the important ones. And I don't know why I didn't go to Winstein. That would have been a perfectly reasonable alternative. I don't recall what went into the decision.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And at that time...
It may have been a reluctance to go all the way to the West Coast. But I was married then. And in fact, that may have been a significant thing. And my wife's parents got married in graduate school, when I got a fellowship in my third year in 1950. And on, because I had a fellowship and had that support, we were able to get married. My wife was working in Manhattan, and her mother lived in New Jersey. And I think the reluctance to leave to go all the way to the West Coast was probably an important thing.
So the first couple of years in graduate school, you supported yourself through TA?
And the GI Bill.
Oh, that still supported you in graduate school as well.
Yes, I husbanded that. See, after all, I got, it must have been something like 2 years of support for that. And that was a marvelous thing for me. Yeah. Wish we had something similar to, you know, it was as good as a fellowship or scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Without it, certainly my career would have been much different. So it certainly had a very positive effect.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I was at Columbia. Remember, we paid for everything. The kind of modern era of where graduate students don't pay for a thing wasn't. Each of us had his or her own account with the storeroom,
mm-hmm.
and we were even charged for ice, 6 cents a bag. And I had an account that was up over $1,000 of equipment that I had checked out. The one thing Durand supplied was solvents and chemicals, but all of the equipment we had to check out ourselves.
But it was returnable on some kind
it
of
it was returnable, but some of the items were consumable.
Yes, yeah, I see.
Glass blowing. All the glass blowing that was done, I had to pay for.
I see.
But as a result, that was my equipment, mm-hmm. and I brought it with me to MIT and to Berkeley.
I see.
And and I used that equipment for many years.
Mm-hmm. The MO calculations, and how
so that started. Roberts had learned the MO calculations from UCLA, the physical chemist there. All right, I know who it is, but he left UCLA, went to Hawaii, and is no longer there. So I'm sure
Roberts told me who he learned it from, and I don't remember now, but I have it on
the tape.
Yeah.
And Roberts may acknowledge it in his preface.
Okay.
And he gave a series of seminars, sort of a mini class, mm-hmm. to several of his students, of whom I was one. And so one of the things I did then was to do a lot of calculations, all the hard way, with a little hand calculator, solving all of the determinants by hand, getting the roots and the energies.
You mean a hand calculator, you mean?
Well, electric calculator.
Yeah, I wasn't. Yeah,
and became very adept at it. And so that was the research that, and the papers that Roberts got from our association. We published several papers together on those calculations.
To hear him tell it, he wasn't very confident about his ability to use these things. I guess that was the way he learned it, through your work, more than anything.
Well, I remember that he imparted what he knew.
Yes.
And my knowledge, of course, wasn't that strongly based. We learned a lot by doing. So I learned doing the actual calculations was straightforward. That was simple. The theoretical basis, or really solid understanding of it, didn't come until years later for me. Just again, learning by doing and seeing
the
relationship.
Very, very time consuming. You must in one paper, I know there were something well over 20 structures that you did.
It was.
It
was very time consuming. One of the things I did on my own, with my own first independent paper, was on the triaryl methyl. Oh, that's a good thing, showing this sort of influence. Roberts used to attend Bartlett seminars, his group meetings.
Oh, yes.
And several of us would go with him. Bill Saunders and I went with him regularly to these meetings. And one of these seminars was given by Norman Lichten, who was, I think, a graduate student of Bartlett's
yes,
at that
was.
Time.
Right.
And he talked about the ionization equilibria of these trimethyl halides in liquid sulfur dioxide, equilibria between these chlorides and the corresponding carbonium ions.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that this provides a good opportunity for getting a quantitative correlation with MO theory.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did those calculations, and that became one of my first independent papers.
Yes.
That was published actually after I got my offer from Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
That worked out reasonably well, and it still is one of the first quantitative correlations of chemistry with MO calculations.
Besides Saunders and Roberts, who else was at MIT that you were interacting with at that time?
Let's see, who was at MIT? I used to also go to Woodward seminars in the evening,
mm-hmm.
and met several of the people there. Mike Rosenblum, I knew from those days,
mm-hmm.
but I think I knew him earlier. I think he may actually have gone back to days that, I'm not sure if we went to the same high school together. If he did, he was a year behind me, something of this sort. Meinwald at Cornell
mm-hmm.
was there in those days. But we also had an earlier association that I think goes back to high school.
Oh, that's interesting.
And there were several other people whose names aren't firm.
No, I'm just interested in the ones you talked to and discussed chemistry with at that time.
Woodward seminars, of course, were an important influence.
Yeah.
Again, an extension of solving problems by modern mechanism. One of the things that was important then was how people had memorized long lists of tables of UV infrared frequencies for carbonyl groups,
mm-hmm.
and what an important that was one of the major tools of the nature of carbonyl groups in those days, whether it was an ester and the size of the ring and so on. I never could do that. I wasn't a natural products chemist, but I was impressed that this is the sort of thing people did.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, was a major change in organic chemistry, of natural products organic chemistry. The first important aspect of the introduction of modern machines. When I was a graduate student, taking infrared spectra was a rare thing. We had one of the first double beam instruments because it was done in Halford's group. And so I have some infrared spectra in my dissertation, but that was rare.
Mm-hmm.
But the first ones, Harvard got one of the first commercial instruments, and this became a major effect, a major thing in, mm-hmm. in Woodward's group, and very rapidly, of course, changed organic chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
MO. Don't know there's much more to say about MO at that point. Howard Simmons was a senior at that time. He was a graduating senior and started graduate school at the time, and he was doing graduate research with Roberts and continued on in graduate school with him. And he's now head of the research at Central Research Department of DuPont.
Yeah. Ed Kossar, you didn't run into at that point.
No, we saw each other occasionally.
Yeah.
In New York and the like.
Yeah, because I know
Ed went off to do. He was an undergraduate at MIT. Did
yes.
graduate work here, and went to Weinstein for.
But he started. He must have been at MIT after the war, because he did the first part of the benzyne problem with Roberts.
No, but he started MIT as an undergraduate
when you started
Whether that may have been later in 45 or early 46. Ed is a year and a half younger than I was. He had a blood problem in those days, so he didn't have to worry about the army.
I see. Okay.
So he didn't accelerate,
okay,
so far as I know,
yeah,
and had a more normal career.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then you came to Berkeley. How did you hear of that job? And
well, I was interested in academic work, and the year I was at MIT was a bad year for school.
Yes.
Academic jobs.
Yes.
There was one at Duquesne. That was about the only position I heard of. I heard a rumor that there was a position at California. And then the next thing I knew, in January, I got a letter offering it to me.
So, and you didn't even apply?
No. Pitzer, in writing to people, had asked, went to Columbia, and Hammett had recommended me.
Uh-huh.
And apparently so did Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was quite a welcome, an unexpected surprise. And naturally I accepted right away, and it was delightful then to have the last 6 months in Boston with an assured position.
Oh, yes.
So we could relax and do something. That's why when I put down in my first independent paper at MIT on these MO correlations, I put down people at Berkeley wondered, who is this guy? I mean, had anyone heard of him? And they hadn't, because they talked to the physical chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the organic chemist who had hired me.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
So, all right, so I came to Berkeley, and what was going on at Berkeley at that time?
Yeah.
Well, Calvin
was
here in full swing in the old radiation laboratory doing the C-14 work, and he had just recently at that point gotten into, so far as I recall, the radio autography approach to looking at paper chromatograms,
mm-hmm,
of the C-14 labeled compounds. Jerry Branch was still alive then. He died early in my career at Berkeley. And
can you tell me anything about Branch? His name keeps coming up, but I
didn't know him very well. He was already close to retirement. He was pretty inactive at that,
mm-hmm,
stage. He was a physical chemist, really, but was active in these areas of physical organic chemistry. But I think his principal contribution was his book with Calvin.
Mm-hmm. Now, Calvin obviously was the younger one, and was he a student of Branch, or?
No, he was more of a student with Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a great deal of a role that Berkeley played in organic chemistry.
Yes, well, that's
first
become very apparent, and presumably because the physical chemists were just so strong here.
Yes, they dominated.
Yeah, the same thing seems to be true at Caltech, and even though Lucas was there, but he was, in a sense, sort of a lone...
Never got a PhD.
That's right, yes. We speculate that he had worked with Stieglitz for the short time that he was at Chicago, but that's not even certain. He was at Chicago, but we don't know.
Well, it was Latimer who, after the war, made the deliberate attempt to bring organic chemistry in.
Mm-hmm.
And he did so by importing Jim Kaysen from Vanderbilt. And Bill Dauben, who was at Harvard,
mm-hmm,
was part of this spread.
Right.
And Bill started here, I guess, as an assistant professor.
he must have come at the end of about 46 or so, about the time that Roberts went to...
46 to 47.
Roberts went to MIT. I know Roberts wanted the job here very badly. I was trying to figure out who came in his stead. And I wonder if...
It would have been Kaysen, and then... and Dauben was the young guy, and Henry Rappaport came around 49.
I see. Mm-hmm. And then,
Or maybe it was even 48, because Don Neuss came around 48.
Yes.
Do you think he, because he came 4 years before me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So there were at least these four organic chemists.
And that was the start of organic chemistry at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Really. And they had already gotten things started when I arrived in 52.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really the next wave.
Mm-hmm.
Jensen and myself. Jensen came in 53.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next tenure man didn't come until the 60s. Clayton Heathcott.
Mm-hmm.
I think he came he
was
64, I think.
It was after...
but he was the next tenure appointment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was about a little over a 10-year spread. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So organic chemistry had its impact during the 50s, but not really before then.
Okay. And really the new wave was well underway by that time.
There was T. Dale Stewart.
That's right, yes.
Who was a physical organic chemist, worked in reaction mechanisms, but never really did a great deal, probably because he didn't have much in the way of students.
Mm-hmm.
He worked in mechanisms of protonation of isobutylene,
mm-hmm.
and mechanism of acid-catalyzed dimerization of isobutylene, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he retired... in my early years here.
Well, he was still here at that time.
Yes. Now, the one other person who had some impact on organic chemistry was Axel Olsen.
Mm-hmm.
He did work in displacement reactions in the 40s,
mm-hmm.
And was one of the people who was involved in showing that every displacement was accompanied by inversion.
Mm-hmm.
So there were several experiments that indicated that. The classical experiment of Hughes and Julius Berger and so on in England,
mm-hmm.
and this work of Olsen's.
Mm-hmm.
But Olsen was really a physical chemist. He actually taught the quantitative analysis course here,
mm-hmm.
and had a textbook in the subject. But his research, at least some of his research, was involved in this kind of work. Reaction mechanisms by kinetics and stereochemistry.
And so these were the people that you were sort of interacting with. Who were you? Who did you talk chemistry with when you got here?
Mostly Don Neuss.
Mm-hmm.
Don and I, he had started a research group, and my research group started in 1953 with one student, and it slowly grew after that. So we held joint group meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And so my principal interaction was with Don, but Bill Dauben had an important influence. It was Bill, for example, who suggested that I write a review on salvolytic reactions.
Okay, that was the next question.
He was the primary stimulus,
mm-hmm.
of that. And he suggested that I give a seminar course on advanced reaction mechanisms, and I did. Very early, I talked about molecular orbital approaches in organic chemistry, and it was on his stimulus that I wrote that Chem Reviews article.
Mm-hmm.
And that came at just the right time. A year earlier, and I wouldn't have known enough, I wouldn't have been prepared to do such a review. A year later, and my research group was too large, I wouldn't have had the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it came at just the right time.
Yes, it must have consumed an enormous amount of time.
It did, sure. It was very time consuming because it took a lot of work in the library. I made use quite extensively of the large amount of literature work I had gone through in preparing my dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, it took a lot of work after that.
Mm-hmm.
When you came, what kinds of problems did you feel did you tend to work on? What kinds of problems did you think were the important ones to work on at that point?
Well, there were two. One was reaction mechanisms, and the use of stereochemistry as a tool in reaction mechanisms had been very popular. It was one of the things that was used in the Hughes and Ingle group, and in Döring made extensive use of stereochemistry as reaction mechanisms, as did Weinstein. So that was one of the things in the zeitgeist. And I had this new tool of the primary carbon.
Yes.
And so the development of that to go on and use it to explore the stereochemistry of various reactions at primary centers involved was a good part of the work of the first decade. That was helped a great deal by my first graduate student, the first graduate student who filed the dissertation, Bill Schaefer. Bill was a student who had a master's degree from Redlands College on the peninsula, went to work at Union Oil and in Brea, and decided he was just there for a year or two and saw the handwriting on the wall. He knew there was, as a non-PhD, there was only so far he was going to go. So he came back to take a PhD, and he worked with me. I think he was a year older than I was at the time. Mm-hmm. But it was a deliberate thing on his part, because it involved the kind of chemistry that was new and he wanted to learn. And he also knew that the problem I presented, that he could get results and get them fast and get a quick PhD. Mm-hmm. And he did. And what he did was to make a large batch of optically active primary butyl alcohol with this deuterium stereochemistry, and then used it in a lot of reactions, and ended up with 7 papers. So that was a great collaboration, and very good for me, because he was very good in the lab, very experienced, and we both got a good deal out of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He went back to Union, and about a year later was promoted to group leader. And it's done very well there since.
It worked out very well. Yeah.
Yes. So his temporary sacrifice, of taking a leave of absence and quitting the industrial salary to come back was worth it to him.
I just remembered that the first paper, the one from MIT on the optically active alcohol, I think just followed the Westheimer paper. They were sort of back to back. Did you know about his work at the same time?
Yes.
Seems to me that somebody acknowledged somebody else.
I had put in a communication on it, and the communication was turned down on the grounds that this is interesting, but optically active deuterium compounds had been made before, and it wasn't worth a communication, and I should put in as a full paper. And it was in that interim period that the Westheimer stuff also came out, and Frank proposed that we publish together.
Mm-hmm. I guess generous and his part to wait, or whatever it was.
I don't know who the referee was.
Yes.
Who turned down the communication.
Yes, maybe he knew. That's a problem.
Now, the other part of the beginning research was the MO.
Mm-hmm.
And the aspect there was that at that point there had been a fair amount of work done on molecular orbital theory and its development and applications to organic chemistry, but not much in the way of quantitative correlations. And Dürer had started his work in the late 40s and early 50s. Coulson and Longit Higgins had done a lot in the late 40s. The whole aspect of the application of simple MO theory to organic chemistry forms a part of your history, because actually the MO theory was developed virtually simultaneously with resonance, or valence bond theory. Both of them, in fact, they both occur in Erich Kuckel's first paper on the subject. He has his method 1 and method 2, and 1 is equivalent to the valence bond method that was done independently by Pauling and developed by Pauling, and the other is a simple HMO theory. But this gets into Erich Kuckel, his personality and the like. He was not a salesman. He couldn't give a seminar, so no one paid any attention to it. And so he played very little role in the development of theoretical organic chemistry of the 1930s, not at all like Pauling. Yet Kuckel himself realized the fundamental importance of 4N plus 2. He has a paper in the middle 30s that shows that he understands why cyclopentadiene is so acidic, because it has this 6-pi electron ring and benzene and so on. But nothing was done with it. The only one of his countrymen who understood the significance of it was his brother,
Walter.
And he gives quite a bit of this in his book, but it had no influence at all in Germany. And it wasn't until the British took it over in the 40s, with the work of primarily Coulson and Longett Higgins, in around the middle 1940s, and then especially by Dewar after that, and his contribution. And then almost simultaneously, I mean, Dewar had had applied, he has his famous paper in 1952, a series in JACS on perturbation approximations with simple Kuckel theory. And one of my ideas when I first started in Berkeley was to see experimentally how good Kuckel MO theory is by trying to do correlations with actual reactions or quantitative reactivities of compounds to which the MO theory could be applied, namely aromatic compounds. And Dewar had the same idea independently and at the same time, and we both worked on this. And I expect for that period we're virtually the only ones who were doing this kind of work. But he was in a more advanced position than I was, and for one thing understood the basis of MO theory much better than I did. Although he was self-taught, and he had to teach this to himself in the 40s.
Yeah. In a sense, you were almost self-taught. If all your background came from Roberts, then
that's true.
At least
the interesting thing is that even though Berkeley had all these physical chemists, I couldn't learn much from them. It was very difficult for me to talk to them and understand them. So I was still self-taught in all of the. When I wrote my book, and in that section on applying it to spectroscopy, that was entirely self-taught. The how to use symmetry and the like, that had to do myself.
Was there anyone that was interacting with you here at that time on the?
Well, I interacted with a number of people, but not at that kind of level, not in a teaching student sort of level. I could go and ask people questions, and there were some areas where they were very helpful, but others where they weren't. So the other, that was one of the things. Then one area that came out that was important was the secondary isotope effect.
I remember that one.
That came out around 1955, and this has its origins back in when I was still a postdoctorate. I kept a notebook of research ideas, and one of the research ideas I put down was to explore the use of deuterium isotope effects as a test of hyperconjugation in carbonium ions. And it turned out that a postdoctorate working with Bartlett conceived of the same idea independently and actually started work on it earlier. And that was name slipped my mind. I know it so well. Who went to Indiana? Shiner. Yes. Jack Shiner. And so he beat me on that. Now, I continued some of that anyway, looking at the stereochemistry of the effect, but then also looked at the alpha deuterium isotope effect.
Yes.
And we did the first study of it and got a result opposite what I had expected. I had thought that in going from a tetrahedral to a trigonal carbon, that hydrogen shortens and its stretching frequency goes up. So I expected to see the first inverse isotope effect. And instead, we got a normal secondary isotope effect. The rate was down by 10%. And that came as a complete surprise, and I had to go into more of a detailed analysis of it. And that's when I came out with this, the idea that it was the out-of-plane bending frequency that was primarily responsible. Mm-hmm. And I discussed that with Pitzer. And he agreed with me, and I gave a seminar on the subject before the physical chemists.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought it. And so that went in as a communication. And that was probably one of my most important contributions of that early period.
Mm-hmm.
That first discovery of a tool that's been used quite a bit in organic chemistry since, and now also in biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, Andy, but Carol...
...the years in Berkeley, and the early chemistry, the first aspects of MO theory that were the quantitative correlations with experiment, these showed the limitations of molecular orbital theory, and the the way theory actually developed were perturbation approximations took over and are now much more important. That wasn't really evident then.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it was because the quantitatively it was so poor, but the it was not clear in the early late 50s and very early 60s the role to which the nodal structure and of molecular orbitals would really play an important role.
Mm-hmm. Ask one more. We've talked a little bit about your perceptions of the transition of from classical organic chemistry to a more modern organic chemistry to what we have today. That is, and it went through this stage of physical organic chemistry, which may not really be a separate thing anymore. That any organic chemist today has really been well trained in what we consider classical physical organic chemistry.
One way you could characterize it is that the first half of the century was really European organic chemistry. And then there was this transition that occurred in the, probably 40s and 50s. A transition that was marked especially by a particular role of physical organic chemistry that was primarily American, to the stage of modern organic chemistry, which is now much more international. Because now, although the U.S. contribution is still large, it's I perceive that it's diminishing, and that you can see a growth of organic chemistry, particularly on the continent and in Japan, in part because of funding changes. And it's become much more of a modern synthesis, a synthesis orientation involving stereochemistry, reaction mechanisms, specialized methods in which the mechanistic thought, the outgrowth of physical organic chemistry, and the following of reactions by modern instruments have been the two key characteristics. And it's so organic chemistry today is so different from what it was in either of these periods, that long, several decades long period in the first half of the century, then roughly those two decades in the middle to what we have now. Physical organic chemistry clearly does not play the same role now that it did in the 50s.
Do you think there is what we can call physical organic chemistry today? Do you still consider yourself as a physical organic chemist, or
in a sense, I suppose I could, although I'm much more of a generalist. After all, I do organometallic chemistry, lots of synthesis.
Yes.
I still do lots of theory. and still do some what you might call classical physical organic chemistry, our carbon acidity work, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to call myself a chemist.
Yes.
Really, labels aren't as useful.
Maybe I've come full circle. I started all of this with Hammett, who, when I said, "What kind of a chemist did you think you were?" He said, "A chemist," you know, and he said, "I considered myself a chemist because he wrote a text in analytical and an organic text and so on." And so now we're back around again, and people are more generally oriented because.
Even synthetic chemists have to know a lot of reaction mechanisms, but they don't need to know a lot of theory.
Mm-hmm.
But they still have to have lots of good memory, memorize lots of conditions.
Yes. I think that completes this part of the interview. Thank you very much for your help.